going to move over to agenda paper 3. So this is, for those listening, a different type of discussion. This is getting some input from the committee on the start of the PIR process for IFRS's 10, 11 and 12. And I'm handing over to the paper.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. The objective of this session is to provide committee members with a short reminder of the process and the purpose of a post-implementation review. And then we will provide you with a summary of the input we have received in our outreach activities from stakeholders. And we'll ask you to provide your views about the topics that the board should consider for inclusion in the request for information. If you look at slide 4 in agenda paper 3, this is where we are in the process. We are approaching the end of phase 1 that we expect to complete by the end of the year. And in this phase, we have run outreach events with auditors, preparers, users, regional groups, regulators, and the different consultation groups of the ISB in order to get their views about their experience in applying the different standards. Early next year, we will bring the analysis of the input to the board, and the board will need to deliberate on the content of the request for information. We expect to publish the request for information in the first 6 months of 2020. The exact date will have to be decided also in consideration of the different documents that we plan to publish early in 2020. At the end of the comment period of the request for information, we'll bring the analysis of the feedback together with all the other evidence we are collecting, including an academic literature review. And that's when the board will be asked to take a decision on the direction of the project. The board may decide that the standards are working as intended and there is no additional work to perform. They may ask the staff to perform more research and consultation, or they may decide to start some standard setting activity. Slide 5, we have just reproduced the purpose of a post-implementation review as is spelled out in the due process handbook. So the intention is to consider the matters that were important or contentious during the development of the standard and any matters that have come to the attention of the board since publication, including unexpected implementation costs or implementation matters. Now, I will let Jen explain what is the main input that we received from the outreach so far, but let me just point out that, first of all, we're still in the process and we still need to complete our analysis of the topics raised by constituents. And also, the purpose of this stage is not to come up with a list of things that the board needs to consider. It's really to develop some good question to ask in the request for information to make sure that the board receives appropriate and complete input and sufficient to take decisions for the future direction of the project.
Thank you, Philip. If you look at slide number 6, it outlines the major changes introduced by IFRS 10, 11, and 12 compared with their predecessors. IFRS 10 established a single consolidation model based on the definition of control, which replaced the definition IS 27 and SIC 12. And a consolidation exemption for investment entity was introduced as an amendment to IFRS 10. IFRS 11 replaced IS 31 by requiring parties to a joint arrangement to account for their interests according to the rights and obligations rather than the legal forms. And it also eliminates the accounting options for joint ventures. And IFRS 12 provides combined, enhanced disclosure requirements for interest in subsidiaries, joint arrangements, associates, and unconsolidated structured entities. All the three standards were published in 2011 and became effective on 1st January 2013, with 1 year delay in EU area. The major amendment of investment entities became effective on 1st January 2014. Slide number 8 to slide number 10 is a list of agenda decisions reached by the committee about the three standards, which I would not go in depth. The next few slides are feedbacks from meetings with different categories of our stakeholders in phase 1 of the PIR. We've completed around 15 outreach, and generally they say that the standards are working well, especially in relation to IFRS 10, Most stakeholders are fine with the principle in the standard and think that the application is generally satisfactory. Most stakeholders accept that the application of the standards requires a certain amount of judgment. There are aspects where judgment is more prominent, and stakeholders recommend the board to consider if there are ways to clarify the application. However, it's always a trade-off. If we add requirements to clarify specific scenarios, we risk adding complexity to the standard. I will go through these application matters starting from IFRS 10 in slide number 12. Some stakeholders find it difficult to identify relevant activities when two parties have power over different activities in different periods. For example, according to the agreement, development of a new product and subsequently the manufacturing and the marketing of that product are unilaterally directed by two different parties. Stakeholders say it's not always clear how to identify the relevant activity that has the most significant effect on the variable return of the investee, especially when involving estimation of the likelihood of occurrence or non-occurrence of a future event. Some stakeholders express concern about how to separate protective and substantive rights. This is a case when some rights need to be reassessed, whether it remains to be protective due to the change in facts and circumstances, for example, a breach of a bank covenant. Control assessments with less than majority of voting rights have been mentioned by different category of stakeholders. Some are concerned about a situation where other shareholding are dispersed, so-called de facto control situation, and how low the shareholding can be to reach a control conclusion. They also mentioned about the difficulty in continuous assessment of de facto control and how to determine the exact date when control is obtained or lost. Some questioned how to apply paragraph B18 and B19 of IFRS 10, which include factors and indicators to be considered, for example, special relationship with the investees. Stakeholders said sometimes these factors and indicators provide conflicting evidence. And the assessment of the relationship between the investor and other investors, so-called de facto agent concept, de facto agent relationship also is a challenging area of application in practice. Stakeholders are requiring clarification in these areas. Some stakeholders request more specific requirements on principle versus agent analysis, in particular, how to determine the magnitude and the variability associated with the economic interest held by the investor when the profit-sharing arrangement is complicated and subject to future changes in market conditions. For the investment entity exemption, generally stakeholders say that they welcome the exemption and find the fair value information more relevant than the information provided by the full consolidation. However, some stakeholders think that the criteria to identify an investment entity may not be rigorous enough and leave room for some entities to achieve their preferred outcome by choosing to or not to apply the investment entity exemption. Well, next one, accounting for transaction with changed ownership interest. Some stakeholders find that there are gaps in existing standard for particular type of transactions. For example, a transaction in which an investor loses control and retains an interest in a joint operation. Some stakeholders say that existing requirements are scattered across different standards and they prefer more comprehensive requirements. Now let's move on to IFRS 11. The application matters raised by stakeholders are substantially those that have been submitted to the committee. Some stakeholders find the application of other facts and circumstances criteria burdensome and ask for simpler analysis based on the commercial purpose of the joint arrangement. Another focus area of IFRS 11 related to the accounting for joint operation. For example, stakeholders ask for accounting requirements when the output taken by the parties of joint arrangement is disproportionate to the interest held by two parties. And another matter is related to a recent agenda decision accounting for the lease liability by a joint operator when the joint operator signed the lease contract with third parties on behalf of the joint operation. We didn't hear many comments on IFRS 12. Some stakeholders are interested in how disaggregated information disclosed should be according to the standard, and others are concerned about the identification of a structural entity when applying disclosure requirements. The staff think that some of these comments are already addressed by the existing standards, so that we need to investigate more to find out whether it's a problem with the requirements or a lack of compliance with the standard. Apart from the application matters, we also receive feedbacks about other matters or additional information needs, such as more granular information on assets liability in subsidiaries with material non-control interest, or the composition of the NCI, more information on how material NCIs impact operating cash flow, etc. Some stakeholders expressed their interest in receiving additional information regarding a multi-layer investment entity group, specifically information of an intermediate subsidiary when it is an investment entity itself, and therefore measured at fair value by its investment entity parent. They say that information about the underlying investments held indirectly by the intermediate subsidiary and other financial information such as cash balance, such as borrowing used to finance the investments, has been obscured by the fair value measurement for the investment intermediate subsidiary. To address this matter, some stakeholders suggest full consolidation of some, if not all, of the intermediate subsidiaries by the investment entity parent. People also ask for accounting requirements for collaborative arrangements when no joint control can be identified, and therefore IFRS 11 cannot be applied. So I have to hand back over to Filippo for the question for this session.
I think we have a general question. I'd like to understand whether the matters that we have reported are being raised by different stakeholders. And of course, different stakeholders are given different emphasis to each of them. Are in line with your experience in applying the standards and being part of the committee? And also, if you have some other application or topics that you think we should bring to the board to be considered for inclusion in the request for information.
I think, I think when I first joined the committee, there were a lot of discussions about IFRS 10, 11, and 12. And I think also from just a preparer's experience, from our experience, the challenges that we have most often are on the joint operation and how to practically account for what's conceptually required. So I think this is maybe a plea for a balance between maybe conceptually correct and theoretically correct and having the standards be something that people can actually apply. Some of the practical points that have been raised in prior agenda decisions, and specifically maybe the joint operator's share of output purchased differs from the share of the ownership interest. Over time, maybe that balances, but at quarters and at year ends, you could have a difference. And so what do you do with that? Where does it go? Even if it's not material, you've got to figure out, where do you book the thing? And just practically speaking, how do you kind of work through that? I will also say that, from internal conversations about joint operation, joint venture, there's not an appreciation of the difference between joint operation and the old proportionate consolidation. There just isn't. And I think there is an intent. It is different. The accounting is different. But I don't know that it's very well appreciated, perhaps outside of kind of the geeky accounting. Sometimes what we do is refer to as accounting shenanigans, but which I don't agree with. But I think there's some pretty important practical matters that are relevant on that particular topic. And then maybe one other point. This wasn't something that we've experienced. Or at least I haven't experienced personally as a preparer, but the one topic that we covered on the joint operator or one of the joint operators signing a lease on behalf of the joint operation, I had a lot of sympathy for the kind of practical application of if the joint operation is not a legal entity in and of itself, somebody has to sign the lease. So for practical purposes, somebody having to sign the lease, does that in and of itself, you have a little bit of form over substance on both sides, and you get to slightly different answers. And so we interpreted what the standards say, and I believe the answer that we got to was the right answer under the standards, but I question if that's really the right answer. So I just, the joint operation is, I know it's a tricky one, but I just think there's some practical challenges with applying that in real life, and I that would be the one area of focus that I would really like to see addressed.
Okay. Paul?
I think this is a really good, comprehensive list of application issues. While you have more IFRS 10 issues listed than IFRS 11, I'll tell you, I don't get, these are the two issues I get in IFRS 11, but I get more IFRS 11 questions than I get in 10. The one I thought about in 10 that I didn't see, got early on, I haven't had in quite a while, is potential voting interest options and how those can affect when you have control with less than a majority.
Lisa?
From my perspective, IFRS 10, I think it works very well. You come up with the very sensible answers in applying the approach. The one thing I noticed was on slide 12, where you talk about where you can have two or more shareholders with different rights at different periods. I think the thing that we see is that you can have two different shareholders having different rights at the same time. And so it's about how do you analyze that and determine it. And then it'd be on IFRS 12, it would be interesting, especially around the disclosures on unconsolidated structured entities, just to see, you know, if my understanding is a lot of this is maybe from analysts wanting to see this information and, you know, how useful, maybe questions around how useful is the information that's being provided in that disclosure. Is it providing what was originally intended? Because that is one of the areas where that population, you know, everyone does the best to get the information, but it's not necessarily always going to be 100% correct. And so is it really providing what it was intended to do?
And with a banker's hat on, thinking about SPEs and working out what you do in terms of the control assessment and also the usefulness of the information that comes from the outcomes, is there anything specific we should be focusing on?
The outcomes of from just the analysis around the control?
Are you consolidate or not, and whether you think it reflects the economics in a useful way?
Yeah, I think overall, I mean, it's around the economics. I mean, some of the things that some pressure points is around when you look at the principal versus agent, there is a lot of judgment there. So, yeah, how do you actually analyze that? But I think overall it works well. I always come to
the sensible.
I
didn't have an agenda.
I think it's a sensible answer.
Bertrand?
Yeah, Mike, I think the experience we have is that 10, 11, 12 work well. I wouldn't say we have practical difficulties in applying them. We can have practical questions, but not difficulties. I mean, we can find the answers by applying the principles in the standards. So no real difficulty. Maybe on IFRS 11, I can appreciate we had in France in the past proportionate consolidation with unproportionate interests. So we already used to having those potential dissymmetries like IFRS 11 is providing as an answer in some instances. I don't see that as a major difficulty, I would say. My comment maybe is I honestly don't really understand why the committee has done in the past a distinction between registered and not registered joint arrangements. I think this is something that could be addressed again by the ISB. Do you really want to have such a distinction? It's as if in IS-19 we had a clear different distinction between legal obligation and implicit obligation, and you don't account for any liability when you have an implicit obligation, which is quite strange, I mean, as an answer. And I receive this as something a bit similar with IFRS 11, disregarding totally IFRS 11 requirements for non-registered entities. I mean, or it's something that is quite strange as an outcome, and that could be revisited by the board eventually while you're reconsidering the post-implementation review.
Separate vehicle or not.
So whether it's a separate vehicle or not, a legal entity.
Unincorporated? Unincorporated, yeah. Sorry.
Carsten?
I also think it's already, you know, quite a comprehensive and good list that's been prepared. So I'll just have a few, just a few remarks in terms of what could be considered in addition. First of all, the whole area of, you know, fund management space. Lots of questions, I think, not just on variable returns and principal versus agent, but also what I'm hearing, at least, is what do you do if you do not consolidate, the whole thing about significant influence and how you make that assessment. That's one area, perhaps, worth in terms of IFRS 12 disclosures. In terms of IFRS 12 disclosures, what I'm hearing is that sometimes, the requirements are only to disclose your interest in a particular non-consolidated entities. But, you know, what if that is just a holding entity and you have operations or other structured entities below that, and whether the disclosure requirements are, you know, sufficient in that regard? And the final observation I wanted to make is around NCIs, in particular the definition of NCIs. I think there's some questions around that as well. For example, if you have some sort of equity that's not the typical equity in a subsidiary. So it could be either, let's say a perpetual loan in a subsidiary that's classified as equity. How do you present that in the consolidated financial statement? Could be other equity components such as share-based payment and things like that. How is that presented in the consolidated financial statements, and how do you split between NCIs and controlling shareholders' equity?
Thank you. Michael?
We're very interested in this post-implementation review. I think just two aspects to add, because I think this is a good list. One is on structured entities. So I think when the standard came in, I think we may have expected more change than actually happened when we moved from the risk and rewards model of 612 towards the control, especially for, the entities with no decision-making rights and the like. And I'm not sure we saw big changes. So I think it would be really interesting for the post-implementation review to see if people are applying the new principles and applying them consistently in that regard for SPVs. And then also in IFRS 12, and I think this is quite tricky because of the stage of the economic cycle since 2014, but part of the rationale for 12, as I recall, was things that appeared on balance sheets in 2008-09, which had never been mentioned before. So one interesting way to see if 12 works is, have there been entities which have been consolidated which had been in the IFRS 12 disclosures previously, where there's been step-ins and the like? Now, there may not have been much of that, but that would be one way of testing whether 12 is working.
There are a few studies, but we have found some study that look into that, but, not very big sample, so I'm not sure that you can really draw. We have something, I think, from Australia and from some other jurisdiction about studies that have looked into what has been the change in the number of consolidated subsidiaries. Of course, the problem is partially that the standard is only one possible reason for a change. You may have sold subsidiaries or bought new subsidiaries, so it's difficult to isolate the impact of the standard.
Carl.
Yes. It's just a
regret, not of mine, it's a regret for a relevant part of stakeholders involving the end of the proportional consolidation. I've hearing, I assume it will not be open for discussion again, but I have to say it's still loved by analysts. I can say by the analysts that cover my company, the almost 100% of the analysts still require and prefer to analyze service concession arrangements worldwidely speaking, using the proportional consolidation. So a lot of people regret the end of the proportional consolidation permission. And similar to Bonnie, I do struggle with the joint operation arrangements, and to me, it's my sense is it's always a means to achieve the proportional consolidation in practice. I really struggle with how feasible are pure operation joint operations in practice. To me, my personal view is just a way to achieve proportional consolidation. Therefore, I would reflect if we should cancel, for example, this in this statement, because I think it's structuring, it's pure structure.
Okay.
In most of the cases, to achieve proportional consolidation at the end of the day.
Okay, thank you.
Makosha? Yeah, thank you very much. So that this is just a very general comment, and thank you very much for the staffs on this presentation material. It's really, really comprehensive, and I think that it's picking up good points. So that for the IOSCO level, we have collected a couple of information from members, and I have here, but I'm not going to read through all the topics here. But my impression is that, you know, that some member jurisdictions, that they do not have any kind of, you know, serious issues for the implementation of those IFRS 10, 11, and 12. But some members also have a couple of cautious of the implementation of those standards. And it's not you know, the consistent problems in all member jurisdictions, but I think that some members need you know, that further guidance or clarification on a couple of standards. Like one example is that IFRS 10 de facto agents, and some members say that you know, that they need clarification on this. Also that there was also a need for the further guidance on the IFRS 12 on the composition of the group, and also disclosures for the investment companies. So this is you know, that just an example of some member jurisdiction, but I suppose that you know, that further communication with the stakeholders is very important. And I also hear that ESMA would also have a study on the disclosures, among others, to answer some of the questions of the request for information. So I think that this kind of a study could be also a help for the ISP. That's it. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you. Bruce?
Thanks. Maybe it's just a bit of a jurisdictional issue, but in South Africa we have some very unique situations. We've got a lot of empowerment companies and a lot of schemes that are undertaken to obviously empower previously disadvantaged people. But those create some very interesting issues under IFRS 10, because we end up with situations where companies have got different classes of shares with different voting structures, and some of the shares only get powers after a certain amount of time, some don't. So just something interesting that I think we've got some rather unique challenges that could be of interest to the staff. I'm not going to go into them all now, but when you guys start looking into those consolidation issues, we've had a lot of kind of, should we say, creative ways that people have done those types of transactions, which have resulted not just in the way down, but also when you've got people owning you, it has quite a big impact in terms of how you're classifying things. So those are quite interesting. On our first 11, I was just going to say,
and a little bit better, your point is that there are different classes of share that give different rights.
Yeah, I mean,
how you count those rights in order to
Absolutely. So there are a whole lot of permutations. So there are certain classes of shares that can only be bought by certain classes of historically disadvantaged people. Now, the question is when you've got restrictions on the shares and certain voting rights that don't apply, it's how all of that ties into the definition of control when you're trying to determine what are the most important rights, what are those. So it's yeah, I mean, I don't want to get into it now because you could probably spend, like we have in that country, years trying to decipher these, but there are some more consistent ones, so I think you've some interesting feedback into that. On the joint operations, yeah, I mean, joint operations has still caused a bit of a challenge. I think that distinguishes. I'm glad that's been picked up in terms of joint operation versus joint venture. We've still had a number of people getting that. The only comment on IFRS 12 was one. I know the board are looking at the disclosures around things like 19 and 13 and that. I mean, this to me struck me as a good opportunity to revisit the disclosures in 12 on the same basis to say, well, if we're going to go through that exercise, should we be asking, is this the opportunity to kind of rethink the entire area of disclosure around IFRS 12? Because my view is anywhere we're going now, you need to be rethinking the disclosures, you know, and given that's being opened up there. And then also just the unconsolidated structured entities. One of my concerns about unconsolidated structured entities is that we tell people, is the guidance as to when something actually is an unconsolidated structured entity and when it isn't. My experience has been that a lot of people say, well, we understand what IFRS 12 says, but when we're actually getting there is not very clear. And I'd just be interested in if the question's being asked from other people. Is that a problem? Other people battling to identify when you have got an unconsolidated structured entity and now you give that disclosure? Because I generally find from my experiences, when it is an uncontrolled structured entity, people don't want to be talking about it. So they're generally using the guidance, finding any way in the guidance to avoid doing it. So it would be interesting to maybe see if that just needs a bit more regulation around it.
A secret trick to encourage consolidation.
Exactly. Exactly the point of the standard.
Mary, have you got some input for the staff?
I have a further request for the interpretation committee members in making their comments, which is, you know, I think good accountants that you are, that I hope we all are around the table, we worry about the completeness of the list and the comprehensiveness and making sure we have everything here. But some of your advice on, yes, that may be an issue that you hear, but let's not go wild about it, because remember that everything that goes, you know, that we identify, we have to consider whether we pursue, and that's, I'm not just worried about our time, I'm worried about all your time as we go out for consultation and people write letters and consider the follow-up and how we prioritize those. So I think some of the valuable input you can give us is, yes, that may be true, or as Bob said, yeah, initially we had some stuff about potential voting rights, but it hasn't come up more. That helps us to kind of figure out what we focus on in the request for information, because comprehensive isn't necessarily the best thing. And then, Bruce, just one thing you said, especially at the request for information level, it doesn't automatically mean that we're opening up anything about disclosure. So I don't think there should be any presumption that we would reconsider disclosure requirements just because we're doing a PIR. That may be what comes out of the whole consultation process, but it's not a given that that's going to happen. And part of me making this comment is expectations management. But I do think, especially when we're dealing with a group of standards that certainly had some challenges in the implementation, that we not use it as a bring out your dead and everything that you ever, you know, that you ever thought about it, or we will still in, well, you all, I will be gone, but some of you in 10 years' time will still be doing the follow-up of the, you know, of the every last thing that was enumerated in the PIR. I'm not trying to kill things or take, you know, put them out of limits. I just want to offer that caution and ask you to think about advice you can give about, I'd worry less about this or maybe list it as other issues that were identified, but this is what I think you should focus on in the RFI.
Guy?
Well, maybe I'll try and embed some of what Mary was suggesting in my comments. I was going to say that the list seemed pretty comprehensive to me, similar to what others have said. You know, if I try and focus on the items on that list that can create a meaningful diversity in terms of outcomes that we're seeing, I would call out some of the things in IFRS 10 where there is quite an inordinate amount of judgment necessary to apply the standard. So the de facto control assessment, the de facto agent assessment, and the principal versus agent assessment, by their nature, are all very judgmental. But I believe there is quite a bit of diversity out there in how parties are approaching those judgments, and faced with the identical fact pattern, you put 10 people around the table and you're probably going to have a wide array of judgments being drawn, and that's often the difference between consolidating or not consolidating, which can have a pervasive impact on the financial statements. You know, having called that out as one of the areas where there is room for is diversity today, and it has a meaningful impact on the financial statement presentation, I don't have any great suggestions on how to sort of bring that together. These are, by their nature, very judgmental areas, but you know, it is perhaps something that warrants a look as part of the PIR to see if there is a means of trying to bring more consistency in terms of how people approach those judgments. Maybe within a similar vein, where things can have a meaningful effect, and this is again a question of consolidation or not consolidation, is in the investment entity space. And I think one of the what I would suggest is the most difficult areas there is trying to judge what is an investment entity within a larger group, and trying to apply the definition of investment entity to, you know, a component of a larger group. And that can be the deciding point as to whether you consolidate further down or just fair value. And it is quite a practical challenge to try and identify what constitutes an investment entity within a larger group. And again, that's the difference between consolidation or non-consolidation. If I think about other sort of broad areas are impactful, and you might tell me these really aren't the IFRS 10, 11, and 12 PIR, but something else. You know, one of the things that comes to mind is combined financial statements rather than consolidated financial statements. A standard around the preparation of combined financial statements. Now, that is perhaps beyond 10, 11, 12, but yeah. Something different.
Agenda consult. Yeah, that's
next discussion.
Again, these may be other projects. So the conflict between 10 and 32 on NCI. That's maybe a financial instruments project rather than a 10 project. the conflict between 10 and 28, and we have the deferred standard out there. I don't know if that's not seemingly mentioned in the slide, but maybe that's because that's the equity method project rather than this PIR. To your point, Mary, about there's lots of other things. Do I really need to focus on them? If I come back to some of the comments on IFRS 11, we would all admit, enormous challenges in adopting that standard, working through the issues. But I think in a lot of respects, we've landed in a pretty decent spot there. And I don't relish the idea of having to go through all of that all over again. There are some unresolved issues there. A few of them are on the list. But I'm not sure I'd want to sort of take a whole fresh look at that. I think in a lot of respects, we've landed in a pretty good spot. There are a couple of issues with respect to 11 that weren't on the list that I'll mention. And these are perhaps somewhat narrow, but I'll mention them for completeness. One of the things that IFRS 11 envisions is parties that don't participate in joint control, other parties, can account for their rights to assets and obligations for liabilities similar to other operators in a joint operation. But as soon as there is a change to the joint control of that joint operation, that accounting for the other party falls away, even though that other party may still have rights to assets and obligations for liabilities. So that's kind of a strange nuance of IFRS 11. Another IFRS 11 issue that I don't think was on the list was the unit of account for classification. So within a joint arrangement, if I have an element of it that isn't through a structured, is through a separate vehicle, and an element that isn't, you know, is it conceivable that within that I can have a JO and a JV, or do I need to analyze the whole thing and conclude it's one or the other? You know, I think that maybe there may be some diverse views on that currently still. But again, on IFRS 11, I think we're tinkering around the edges at this point. I wouldn't be in a camp of saying we need to start again on that by any stretch. We've worked through the more difficult challenges there. I'll stop at that.
Thank you. All right.
Thank you. And we discussed this topic at the CIMAC meeting last month, so that this is a kind of repetition. But you know, I pointed out that the possible contradiction between the IFRS 10 and the IFRS 9, that the IFRS 10 requires an entity that has lost control of subsidiary to remeasure any eligible interest at fair value through profit or loss. And the IFRS 9 allows that so-called OCI option, and it allows an entity to elect to carry equity instruments at fair value with the changes recognized in other comprehensive income, so that this could be a potential conflict. And also that at the CIMAC meeting, that some members shared that concern about the detail, that the these members are pointing out that who are advocating the reintroduction of proportional consultation. Okay, thank you.
Yang Su?
The most of the things that I have in my mind has already been mentioned by the others. I just want to say one thing. It is about the protective right. Protective rights are the rights related with the fundamental change. But we never know what is a fundamental change. On the other hand, that would be the ordinary activities of the business. But we don't know what is the ordinary activities of the business. So that we have to ensure we have to define those two things to avoid any confusions about the productive right and the substantive right. That's only one thing I want to add.
Bob?
I'll make this quick. Just a quick question. I was curious. The concept of control differs across standards. Is that something that we look at in the PIR, in an agenda consultation, or
can
not at all?
Control?
Does it?
I have a question for you, Bob. Why are you saying that the concept of control is different across standards?
Well, the prime example is stickiness. You've got, so 15, 16 are control standards. They consider stickiness. 10 is a control standard, doesn't consider stickiness.
What do you mean by stickiness?
Oh, it does.
Stickiness, if you... If I owned something before, and then I give it to you, but I have a right to get it back... Sometimes we consider it as I still have retained control,
yeah.
And sometimes we say, no, I don't have control.
Okay.
So it's not really common because, Bertrand, I'm like you, and I think that broadly, and let me come back to I think the point you're raising, Bob, is at least that when the board has developed control and thought about control, I use the words more recently, over the last 10 years, let's say 10 or 12 years, to me it's actually applied a very similar notion of control. And what cuts across IFRS 15 on control, IFRS 16 on control in terms of definition of a lease, IFRS 10 on control, is that notion that control requires both, you know, powers, exposure to variable returns or benefits, and kind of that those two pieces come together. So that's very consistent, and how those broad notions of control have been developed are all along the same lines. Now, where there are differences is, first of all, is that to me, the board had to, you have to sometimes make the way that control concept work a bit differently when you're talking about control of an entity versus control of an asset. So there's some what I might call, fine-tuning differences between how, say, exactly the concept of control works in 15 and 16, because it's thinking about an asset versus 10 was thinking about an entity. I think what you're highlighting then, that is in some respects, there's almost some, what would I call it? I shouldn't use the word exceptions, but enhancements. Enhanced explanations to how control works, I suppose, in particular situations. So if I think about IFRS 15, you're probably thinking in terms of stickiness.
Or potentially for derecognition.
Yeah, exactly. So it's about, you know, sale and repurchase, when we're thinking about sale and lease back in terms of IFRS 16, and as you say, Sue, thinking about...
retained interest.
Yeah. So there's sometimes in terms of from a derecognition perspective, there have been some stickiness, in a sense, considered that has enhanced and added to some of the basic control concepts. But I suppose I'd say I think the basic control concepts are set up in a very similar way within some...
I agree with you. The prime is in agreement. It's on the edges.
Yeah,
we have
exactly.
Some difference.
But I guess to answer your more basic question, I think for the PIRs, we're really looking at, did things work the way we planned, and are there particular issues that have come up, or there's particular circumstances where we're not perhaps getting the useful information we might have anticipated, or operational challenges. So it's much more, is there a problem to be solved?
Okay.
Something which I think is more profound, which is more what you're talking about, which is should we take a step back and think about control more comprehensively and differently? I think my reaction to you would be it probably feels to me more like an agenda consultation type suggestion rather than something that would come out of the PIR of particular standards. Never say never, but that's my sense.
I think there's just one thing to add to what Trina said, Bob, as well. I think there's a perspective question as well, because this came up when we did some of the derecognition stuff, where it kind of mattered whether you were taking the customer's perspective or the entity's perspective. I remember that in IFRS 15. And so you can have the same definition of control, but it kind of can affect the stickiness question, I think.
Okay, Filippo, have you got what you need?
I think yes.
Excellent.
Well, thank you very much, but if there is any other thoughts that comes to mind, please don't hesitate to contact us.
Okay, thank you very much. All right, let's take a break until 3:45, so 10-minute break. Okay.